shook hands with the guest of honor beneath the shade of 8 Ionic columns, then passed through to the center of the house and down the outside staircase, following the music and the smell of good food. I'd given Leah the job of recording the entire event for posterity on a camcorder. You're the producer, the director, the sound man, and the gaffer all rolled into one. Make like Fellini. Make us all famous, I had told Leah. For the rest of the afternoon, Leah wandered in her white dress through the immense, good-natured crowd. She was now as much a part of Waterford as anyone there, and each time she aimed her camera at a strange cluster of people, someone would notice her, step back, and introduce the entire group to her. More than once, I heard some man or woman she had never met say, "Lord, child, if you aren't the spitting image of your pretty mama. Charlotte took ballet lessons with my grandchild, Bailey, and if those two just didn't have a time, she was graceful as a lily on stage. I know, child, I was there." Leah seemed relieved to have her camera between her and the lost country of memory these people claimed to see with such clarity when they stared at her features. Every time I overheard the name Shyla, I felt again the cold solitude of being motherless that was being pressed on Leah. And I was glad she had the camera as a fence to protect herself, an excuse to be invisible. Cameras are a lifesaver for very shy people who have nowhere else to hide. Behind a lens, they can disguise the fact that they have nothing to say to strangers. As I kept 8 pots of salted water turning out perfectly cooked pasta, it seemed as though the drama of my whole life paraded by. Mrs. Lipsitz, who had fitted my shoes during my entire boyhood, ordered spaghetti with pesto sauce from me as she stood chatting with Mr. Edwards, who sold me my first suit. He had come with Coach Small, who had taught me how to throw a curveball, and Coach Singleton, who had shared the secrets of downfield blocking with me. He stood near Miss Economy, who once made me sing "God Rest Ye Merry Gentlemen" solo on New Year's Eve, when the ice storm hit Colleton and killed an oak tree that had been growing along the river when Columbus discovered America. Over 50 black people mingled through the crowd, and I thought again how lucky I was to have been raised by Southern parents who not only were not racists, but who worked with uncommon zeal to ensure that we were uninfected by the South's virulent portable virus. Our parents represented something very fine and dangerous at a time when Southern whites stood shoulder to shoulder to demonstrate their attention to ideas both insupportable and un-American. In 1956, when I was just 8 years old, my father, Johnson Haygood McCall, was a brilliant, if irascible, jurist. At that time, in the early apprenticeship of his drinking, lawyers dreaded his court because he did not tolerate lack of preparation or the wasting of his time. His tongue lashings of counsel were famous and withering. His court sessions were orderly and his judgments fair. Though Johnson Haygood was neither a good father nor an admirable husband, the law ennobled him and brought out aspects of character that surprised even him. But it was not a good time in South Carolina history to combine valor with a judge's gavel. He was a circuit judge of the 14th Judicial District and was away from Waterford for long periods of time in that position. The case that brought him to grief was simple but controversial in the rural county where it came to trial. A high school English teacher by the name of Tony Calabrese had been fired from his job for advocating openly in his classroom the integration of the public schools. Mr. Calabrese was employed by the Reese County School Board, and Reese County was known all over South Carolina for the backwardness of its citizens. My father referred to Reese County as the incest capital of the world, and he held its lawyers in utter contempt. Tony Calabrese admitted that he had advocated the integration of schools, but only as a teaching tool and only to stimulate class discussion among students who he felt were brain-dead and bereft of all ideas. It did not help that Tony Calabrese, who had been born in Haddonfield, New Jersey, to immigrants from Naples, was a practicing Roman Catholic and an open Republican. As the trial unfolded, it became apparent to my father that the school board had not followed a single one of the procedures for due process when it fired Mr. Calabrese. On the witness stand, the teacher himself was fiery and unrepentant and gave the counsel for the school board all he could handle. Mr. Calabrese bristled with outrage and stated that the world of ideas would not be eclipsed in any classroom over which he presided, and he would not be bullied by anyone for thinking whatever he saw fit to believe. As my father listened, he thought that the trial of Tony Calabrese was a good thing for every small town to go through, and he found himself silently cheering for the embattled teacher as the mood of the courtroom grew testier and more hostile. He began to identify with this incandescent plaintiff who had brought suit against an ill-prepared school board. Toward the end of the trial, my father asked Calabrese, "How did you get down here to Reese County, sir?" Calabrese looked up and smiled at him, then said, "Just beginner's luck, Your Honor." My father laughed, but his was the only smile in that grim-faced court. He ruled in favor of Calabrese, reinstated him with pay, then made the mistake of lecturing both the school board and the citizenry of Reese County. "You cannot fire a teacher for discussing in class what is contained in the daily headlines of our papers. One may disagree with the concept of integration, but anyone who reads can see it is inevitable. You can fire 100 Calabreses today, but integration will still be coming tomorrow. Calabrese was simply preparing your children for the future. His firing was an act of frustration, because you want so much to hold on to the past. I've read Brown versus the Board of Education over and over again. It's bad public policy, but it's good law. You cannot fire a man for teaching about a constitutional right. Integration's coming to South Carolina, Calabrese or not." That night in Reese County, 10 men in masks came for Tony Calabrese, and though he struggled, they beat him half to death with fists and axe handles. They burnt his car and his house, and they drove him to the state line of New Jersey, where they dumped him, bound up in an oyster sack and blind in one eye. The 10 men who assaulted Calabrese were never caught, but were well known among their fellow citizens, who believed in their hearts that Calabrese had received a well-deserved civics lesson in the Southern way of doing things. The evening after the trial, my father presided over a formal dinner of local officials and their wives, who were meeting at our house to plan a political fundraiser for a young politician by the name of Ernest F. Hollings, who was planning to run for governor. News of Calabrese's disappearance had reached Waterford, and the sheriff had sent word that it might be wise to post a deputy at our house for the next week or so. Since my father felt no sense of danger in his hometown, he was not disturbed at all. But my mother was alarmed a great deal, and as she prepared the meal that night, she checked all the approaches that led to the house, and secretly put in a call to the sheriff to see if there was any late-arriving news about the abducted teacher. She was 6 months pregnant with my youngest brother, John Harden, and she thought she knew much more intuitively than her husband how rural white people felt about the topic of integration. Dallas, Dupree, T, and I were put to bed early, and all the locks were checked on the windows. The four of us had watched her break jelly glasses in the sink that afternoon and place the jagged fragments on the railing going around the veranda. As my mother took inventory of the situation, my father drank. The bourbon made him both self-righteous and less worried about the disappearance of Calabrese. Because of Jack Daniels, my father faced the evening unafraid. Because of Jim Crow, Lucy put my brothers and me all in my room for safekeeping, with the dog, Chippy, guarding the door. Lucy had set her dining room table with great care, and she watched the languorous, confident guests as they slowly drifted into the dining room toward the aromas of baked Cornish hens and wild rice and turnip greens. She watched Becky Trask and Julia Randell take their seats as elegantly as monarch butterflies settling on peonies, while their husbands held their chairs and the candelabra glowed. I was sound asleep when I heard Chippy rouse herself from my bed and walk over to stare out the window into darkness. The hair on her spine stood out erect, and there was a steady growl in her throat. Getting up and going to her, I stared out the window and saw nothing in the moonless night. But I could not calm Chippy. "It's nothing, Chippy," I said, but the hair on Chippy's neck said otherwise, and there was a fierce humming in her throat that my words could not stifle. Suddenly, a brick crashed through the downstairs window and landed squarely on the dinner table. Other bricks followed, and I heard Becky Trask scream when one of them struck her on the shoulder and every chair was overturned in the frantic scramble to avoid that shower of bricks. The half-burned candles were strewn around the room, and my father found himself pressed face to face with the town's mayor, as a voice screamed out in the darkness, "We'll kill you, you nigger-loving judge! We'll kill you dead!" Then a fusillade of rifle fire burst through the window, and I heard the women screaming and the men shouting for each other to do something. Then I heard a shotgun go off just beneath my window, and it seemed as though someone was on the porch, firing at short range below me. "They're going to shoot us down like dogs right here on the floor," I heard the mayor shout at my father, and the shotgun rang out again as the attackers seemed to be running away into the night. Far off I heard a siren sound, which was answered by the steady, hysterical barking of Chippy, locked upstairs with my brothers and me. In silence, the guests were lying on the floor when they saw a shadow cross the threshold of the front door, and in the dim, sputtering light of candles, they watched as Lucy returned her still, smoking shotgun to its rightful place in the closet by the front door. My mother understood the nature of the white people of Reese County far better than my father did, with all his degrees and all the finesse he brought to bear in arcane areas of legal descent. She had prepared the meal and loaded her shotgun just in case there were unwanted visitors who had come to do her family harm. She was firing from the hip when she first opened that front door, and she would have killed any man she had encountered on that blacked-out veranda. The incident marked the first of many times that the town of Waterford would have to revise their opinion about my mother. My brothers and I heard the story of those night riders over and over again during our childhood. The bullet holes were never repaired in the dining room plaster or in the mantel over the fireplace. Those bullet holes served as sacred reminders that our father had the courage of his convictions, and it was important to stand for something of great value in a society that had debased itself with the fury of its own worst instincts. They also reminded us of a father we could take pride in, even though it was a father we hardly remembered. The shotgun pellets from Lucy's surprising fusillade remain embedded in three columns of the veranda as both mementos and lessons for us, her children, and a warning to those who would approach our house with malice and treachery in their hearts. They did so only at their own peril. The Calabrese trial was my father's finest hour. I thought of those valiant days as I watched Governor Dick Riley take Lucy by the hand and escort her down the back steps to the applause of the crowd. Not bad for a redneck girl, Mama, I thought, as I watched Strom Thurmond kiss her hand and Ernest Hollins try to outrun Bishop Unterkofler to get into the photographs that were being taken by newspapers from as far away as Charlotte. The Red Clay Ramblers broke into the Tennessee Waltz, and Joe Riley, mayor of Charleston, danced with Lucy as other couples joined them. Tea-maid Leah put down the camcorder and danced with her favorite uncle. Before the day was out, Leah had danced with half the men in Waterford, growing dizzy trying to place the array of faces with her parents' history in this small, two-steepled town that she could see through the arms of her ever-changing partners. I watched with a secret smile as she was spun across the lawn by the sweet-natured men who had grown up beside this river, walking in and out of my life and Shiloh's. When the Ramblers began a set of beach music songs from the glory days of those long-ago Myrtle Beach summers, I put my chef's toque down amid the plates of steaming pasta and ran out with my apron flapping madly around my legs and asked my mother for a dance. The song was Green Eyes by Jimmy Ricks and the Ravens, and it took me back to the pier at Folly Beach in the summer of 1969, when I had joined all my high school friends on a night ride up the cypress-columned Highway 17 in Capers' new Impala convertible, eight of us drinking and singing along with the radio turned up full blast, as the air, scented with the black water lilies of the Edisto River, rushed over us. I spun my mother into the applause and sunlight and watched Leah recording our dance with the camera as I sang the words of Green Eyes to my pretty mother. I closed my eyes and heard the rhythm of the song, and my mother's hand transfigured itself into Shiloh's hand, and my feet moved along the grass as they had along the wooden floor of the Middletons' house, with the Atlantic moving to the music beneath us, so many years ago. That was a time when our love was an outline and a concordance yet to be agreed on. And Sharla's laughter, as she danced while our classmates screamed their fear at us, was an invoice of collusion and promise of things to come. Sharla wrote a love song that night with her eyes every time she looked at me. She made my bloodstream feel like the place that the gods had defined before they could discover fire. My love for Sharla was different from the love I felt as I danced with my mother, yet there was a relationship that burned with a clear, rough energy within me. The connection felt absolutely sacred to me between the woman who had given birth to me and the woman who had given birth to my sweet-faced Leah, who was now filming this dance. Is there anything on earth more lovely than a son dancing with his mother, famous for her small-town beauty? I thought, and I tried to take the thought even further. I felt lucky that I could love Lucy with a pure, uncorrupted love, because she was the sole possessor of the only mother's face I would ever know. The word mother applied to a single woman on earth, and it hurt me deeply that I had become a fugitive from this woman's confusion about how to love a son. Because of Lucy's extraordinarily tangled character, I knew that mothers could come in a dazzling assortment of disguises. I felt a tap on my shoulder, and Dallas asked to cut in on this dance, and then I saw T and Dupree getting in line to follow suit. After she danced with each of us, she could dance with the rest of the menfolk in town. But then I looked around and noticed that my father seemed everywhere in his unsolicited but welcome role of gray eminence. He roamed through the crowd with the barren and discipline of a ringmaster. Because of his sodden history, his sons kept a close watch on his every movement and traded hand signals with one another when he moved out of one brother's quadrant of vision and into another's purview. After a lifetime observing my father get drunk and the inestimable horror he could wreak on all the lives he staggered into, I had come to understand why the military shot their guards who fell asleep on duty during wartime. I had seen my father ruin a dozen parties as nice as this one. But he was managing to gain perfect control over himself for Lucy's party, even though his sons had suggested the wisdom of leaving off our father's name from the guest list. But Lucy had stopped by the law office and issued the invitation in person. Privately, she told me they had talked together for over an hour, and that meeting had thrilled the judge because of its intimacy and its validation of their years together. "Your mother's quite a package, son," my father said to me. Lovingly, I answered him by saying, "Get drunk and I'll kill you." "I wouldn't think of getting drunk at my own wife's party," he said, with maddening piety. But my father was making good on his word, and he moved from group to group with the dignity of a minister of protocol. He was dressed in an immaculate white summer suit. Carefully, he avoided the central action where Lucy and Dr. Pitts held court, but he conducted himself with impeccable charm and grace. "What a handsome man," I heard someone say to Ladare, and I noticed that Leah kept the camera on her grandfather whenever he glided into view. When the Red Clay Ramblers broke into their rendition of Bert Kaempfert's Wonderful by Night, my brothers looked quickly toward the band, each of them sharing the same thought I had, that money had exchanged hands. It was my parents' favorite song to slow dance to, and I held my breath as I watched the judge approach my mother from across the yard. He bowed deeply at my mother, who stood beside Dr. Pitts. She curtsied in return. My father asked the doctor if he could have permission to dance with his pretty wife, and the doctor made a sweet, accommodating gesture with his arm. They spun out toward the lawn, my father swinging my mother in the broad, show-offy rendition of what had once been a simple waltz. Every other dancer moved to the side, and I could not bring myself to look at my brothers while our parents danced. I could not have spoken to another human being during their 2 minutes spinning on that well-manicured grass. That they danced so beautifully together moved me greatly. That their lives together had been such a perfect disaster shook me more. That these were my parents almost brought me to my knees. I followed them with my eyes and knew that the dance meant as much to both of them as it did to their sons. At the end of the dance, my father led her back to Dr. Pitts, and the two men embraced, and Lucy led the crowd in its applause. Mike and Ladare came up beside me, and we stood together, our arms draped over each other's shoulders, as the Red Clay Ramblers went classic with the beach music and moved right into 60 Minute Man as the crowd roared its approval. "My song, my song," Mike said, shimmying out and motioning for Ladere to join him. Ladere moved out to meet him with the confidence of a cat, measuring the distance between the floor and the tabletop.
"What a good-looking woman," I shouted at her.
"Damn right," she said. "Glad you noticed. Who sang this song, this holy, holy song that should be written down and placed in the Talmud?" Mike asked. "I know. Give me a minute," Ladere said. "It was Billy Ward and the Dominoes," I said. "Jack's my main man," Mike said. "The past is as sacred to Jack as it is to me. Marry me, Ladere. You're the only woman I know that I haven't been married to."
"Could I make you happy, Mike?" Ladere asked.
"Of course not, because I'd still be me, trapped with the mind and soul of Mike Hess, who is satisfied with nothing, who looks all over the world, trying to be as happy as he was growing up here as a kid."
"I want to make someone happy," Ladere said. "I might even have a gift for it."
"Good line. Put it in the script." "Nah, I like you far too much to marry you. My ex-wives hate me. They're all millionaires living better lives than Louis XIV, and they all hate my guts. Go figure. Then call my accountant. He's the one it really bothers. Hey, Grandma, let's trip the light fantastic, darling." Mike moved over with Ladere in tow and lifted Esther Russoff out of her seat as she protested every step of the way. Ladere reached out and took Max Russoff by the hand, and all of them moved among the low country dancers. "Make sure you film this, Leah," I said. "Ladere dancing with the great Jew, Mike dancing with Esther, wife of the great Jew." I spotted Capers and his child bride, Betsy, making political hay as they worked the crowd together. Their smiles were congruent, as though the same orthodontist had set their teeth, using the same wiring. They moved like a pair of lions on the hunt, all concentration and feral grace. They sprang in tandem toward the flanks of voters. Periodically I would see their eyes meet and a flash of recognition pass over them, acknowledging to each other that they made a good team. "Betsy," I said, when they approached my table, "does your insecurity come from long practice, or was it just a natural gift?" Betsy's eyes flashed with anger, but she was far too polished to rise to my bait.
"Oh, Jack, I was just talking about you. I do hope you've already purchased your ticket back to Italy."
"Oh, you're good, Betsy," I said. "What a shame this beautiful friendship will wither from neglect."
"It will if I've got anything to do with it," she said.
"Oh, I like it when you're mean, Betsy," I said. "It excites me."
"Don't let my old friend Jack get a rise out of you, darling," Capers said. "It's me he's got a problem with."
"Glad that's straight," I said.
"I hear that my ex has her eye on you, Jack," Capers said.
"I sure hope so."
"That would make us related in a way," he continued.
"Yes, of course it would," I said. "We plan to name our first kid after you."
"How flattering," he said.
"I just don't think Enema's a very pretty name, do you, Betsy?"
"Jack, Jack," Capers said. "Your manners."
"Excuse me, Betsy," I said. "What got into me?"
"I can't believe you once actually liked this guy," Betsy said to Capers.
"You misjudge me," I said in mock horror. "Once I reminded all the world of the Christ child. Then I read Das Kapital."
"I'm trying to think of where I've met a bigger asshole," Betsy said.
"In church, waiting at the altar, your wedding day, sweetie?" I said. Betsy seemed ready to explode, but instead she spotted a friend across the crowded yard and moved toward her, a huge smile lighting her way.
"Betsy's perfect for you, Capers," I said. "I think that's the worst thing I've ever said about anyone."
Both of us stopped when we saw Mike Hess beaming down on us.
"Your mother's having the time of her life," Mike said.
I looked out where my mother stood in a crowd of admirers and old friends. "She's having a ball. Thanks for doing this, Mike."
"I used to get a hard-on thinking about Lucy," Mike told Capers. "But hell, who didn't?"
"Mike says the sweetest things," I said.
"It's easy to be pretty," Capers said, "but being sexy is an art."
"You should know, Capers, you're both," Mike said.
"A gene pool's the highest-priced waterfront property," Capers laughed, then asked me, "Oh, you hear about Thursday?"
I shook my head and Mike said, "I told Ladere to tell you to keep Thursday evening open."
"What's up?" I said.
"A sound and light show," Capers explained, walking toward Strom Thurmond's limousine as it pulled up to the senator.
"I can't tell you," Mike said. "Capers doesn't even know the specifics, but it's going to be big, maybe one of the biggest nights in all our lives."
"Tell me more."
"Jordan called," Mike said. "He wants us all together one more time."
"I thought he was in Europe," I said, shaken by this information.
Mike laughed and said, "I bet you're lying, Jack, but don't worry about it. Jordan got in touch with me. I didn't have any luck at all trying to hunt him down."
"Where are we going to meet?"
"I can't tell you that," Mike said. "We're still in negotiations. He's like trying to pin down the Holy Ghost. But I think this is the breakthrough for our little film. He wants a confrontation with Capers."
"Why did he get in touch with you?" I asked.
"He finally agreed to let me buy his life story," Mike explained. "I think he wants to turn himself in. If you ask me, I bet he needs the money for his legal defense."
"Mike," I said, catching my friend by the wrist, "if you or Capers try to have Jordan arrested, they're going to find you both floating face down in the lobster tank at Harris Teeter."
"I'm on your side in this, man," Mike said. "Capers wouldn't think about crossing me."
"Be careful with this," I warned. "Half this party attended Jordan's memorial service in 1971. They still think he's dead."
"These are good Christian people," Mike said, his eyes surveying the party. "Resurrection should be an easy concept for them to swallow."
"Who else is going to be there?"
"Negotiations are still ongoing," Mike said. "I've told you more than I've told anyone. Keep Thursday open."
"I can't. I'm going to Fordham's Hardware to buy fertilizer for my African violets."
"You and Ladea come together," said Mike, ignoring me. "I'll call with the details."
"Do people in Hollywood ever tell you to get laid, Mike?" I asked.
"People are terrified of me in Hollywood," Mike said, and his tone was informational, not hostile. "The maggotry can offer no higher compliment."
"I'll see you on Thursday," I said.
"I was a nice kid, wasn't I, Jack?"
"You were wonderful. There's never been a nicer boy," I said.
"You don't like what I've become, do you?" Mike asked.
"I sure don't."
"Not even gravity can stop a free fall, Jack," Mike said, his voice odd with its slight furor of regret. "I once saw myself differently, a young man on the move, a man of distinction and accomplishment. Then I stared watching the movie of my own life and was horror-stricken by what I saw. I embarrassed my own mother."
"Be nicer, Mike. We're Southerners. There's a lot wrong with that, but nice comes easy to all of us. It's who we are."
"Ah," Mike said, his attention drawn to a 1968 Volkswagen convertible that was once yellow but was now unwashed and sun-bleached. "Look what's coming down the Avenue of Oaks. Didn't you drive that car in college?"
"It's been passed down to all my brothers. John Harden's got it now. He's been making a present for Mom," I said.
A piece of furniture covered with blankets hung out of the convertible as John Harden navigated the vehicle between parked cars until he reached the center table where Lucy was holding court. The crowd was smaller now, but her dearest friends were still in attendance, and the bartenders were still busy mixing drinks on two sides of the plantation house. Leah was sitting beside Lucy as she entertained the folks at her table with a series of stories that charmed with their wit, yet contained not a trace of rancor. Leah watched Lucy mesmerize her audience by halting in mid-sentence and raising a single, quizzical eyebrow in abbreviation before delivering her punchline. At home, Leah tried this technique on me, but could not arch one eyebrow without the other following suit. As Leah watched, Lucy's athletic eyebrow rose, aimed at John Harden's car as her son made her way to her. John Harden had the power to unnerve my mother, but her love for him, her wounded baby, was incontestable. She tried not to let her agitation show as he greeted her and her friends with his suspicious but palmy effusions. He had finished his gift and timed it perfectly to present it to her at her party. The crowd applauded as she rose and walked over to the car, her arm holding his. John Harden still glistened from the sweat of his labors. He possessed a theatrical side to his nature that could come off sometimes as bizarre and other times larger than life. With a showman's sense of timing, he made Lucy cover her eyes, and one of the ramblers, catching the spirit of the moment, accompanied the unveiling with a drum roll. Showing enormous flair, John Harden pulled off a series of tarpaulins and blankets that were tied around his gift, then hesitated when he was about to take off the final layer. He gave it a yank,
then lifted his present out of the back seat and laid it at his mother's feet, not noticing at first the gasp of surprise that exploded from the crowd. John Harden had made a coffin for Lucy from an oak tree that lightning had killed on the back side of the Isle of Orion. He laid the coffin out on the grass and demonstrated the workmanship to Lucy, moving her hand across the deeply polished grain of wood as though he had made her a violin from the most delicate, sweetest-smelling woods. The coffin shone, and you could see the grain of the oak where the saw had cut and left its mark. I saw that she, too, had received a shock when John Harden had lifted the last blanket covering his gift, but she had recovered faster than anyone else and knew that in John Harden's prescribed and shaken world, this coffin was the love note of a schizophrenic son who could never tailor his inarticulate, stumbling gestures of ardor to the mainstream. Dallas shook his head and said, "He also brought her 3 gallons of embalming fluid." "Look at the workmanship," Dupree said admiringly. "It's perfect. John Harden ought to be building yachts." "I'd like to say something witty," T said, moving over to be with us, "but I'm the slow-witted brother. I'll think of something hilarious I could have said, but it'll be 2 months from now when I'm getting off an interchange on I-26, or trying to get money from an instant banker when I know my account's overdrawn."
"I know you boys have already said 6 or 7 lines that are drop-dead funny, and you're waiting for me to weigh in with just one. I can't."
Dad's sperm weakened as he aged. Mom's eggs were old and cracked when John Harden and I came along. "Let me just say, I think it's weird to give your mother a coffin when she's got cancer. Yep, that's my statement to the press. Give it to any wire service you'd like."
"He saw a real need," Dupree said. "It may be a bit odd, but it sure saved Dr. Pitts a lot of cash."
"Poor Mom, what a trooper," Dallas said. "Now she's got to thank John Harden like he just bought a wing of a college and had it named after her." Lucy stood on her tiptoes and kissed John Harden on the cheek and pulled him tightly against her. She put his forehead against hers and smiled at him until he blushed. Then Lucy stepped back, looked at the coffin, and played to the crowd. "Who gave my secret away? It's just what I wanted, and I can't wait to try it on." The laughter of the crowd was relieved and grateful. They cheered Lucy's quickness, her deftness at diffusing the situation. John Harden surprised us by responding.
"I wanted to give my mother something that few sons have ever given their moms. Most of y'all know that I've caused my mother great worries because I've suffered from things beyond my control. I worried that my mama would think I made this because I thought she was going to die soon. That's not it at all. Mama always taught her children that words were pretty, but anyone could talk. She said, pay attention to that man or woman who acted, who did, who performed. She taught us to trust in things we could see, not that we heard. I almost die myself when I think of my mother not being here. I can't stand it. I can barely speak about it. But when your time comes, Mama, I want you to know that I made this coffin loving you every minute. I cut the tree down and took it to the sawmill and sanded down every inch of wood. I polished it until I could see my face in its reflection. My brothers put this party together, and I didn't help them a bit. I was doing this. I was afraid it would upset you and your friends. But I pretended that I was building the house you would live in forever. The house you'd be in when God came to get you."
Lucy hugged her son again, and John Harden wept against her shoulder as the crowd cheered even louder. Then he broke away from her, and with his enormous strength, he lifted the coffin as easily as if it were a surfboard, returned it to the back seat of the convertible, and drove out of the vast backyard without even tasting the barbecue. "Upstaged by a schizophrenic," Dallas said. "The story of my life." "No," I said. "What we just saw was more. The party just had a perfect ending."
Chapter 34.
"So, Jack, you think you want to know what happened to me during the war. In your innocence, you believe it will provide answers, the hidden clue, the reason why poor Shyla went off that bridge in Charleston. You think the bridge that took Shyla is connected to the gates of Auschwitz, don't you, Jack? In your life, everything's a recipe. Just follow the directions in order. Be careful with the measurements. Do not experiment. Time everything, and all can enjoy a perfect meal in a safe American home.
but you think I left an ingredient out. Once you have it, you can hold it in your hands, weigh it, smell it, catalog it, add it to the recipe, and voila, throw it in the stockpot. The recipe for the death of Shyla Fox will be complete. Got time for some hell, Jack? Let me give you a brief biography of worms. The worms of Europe were the fattest in the world during those years. I will walk you into the corridors of hell, and I believe you will find my tour memorable and complete. I was there once, given an all-expense-paid trip by the unsmiling travel agents of the Third Reich. You like jokes, Jack. You always have. And I expected you to smile when I said that, but no, you remained grim. No sense to be so serious. You and Shyla always told me that. The past is past. Let bygones be bygones. Okay. So you will not laugh. One promise, though. You must sit through the whole story. No time out for vomiting. No tears. I will try to strangle you myself if you dare shed one Christian crocodile tear over the deaths of the ones I loved. Agree?
Agree, I said.
So, Jack, we come together at last, you and I with our years of contempt for each other. No one else knows how deep it is or how long it has existed between us. I hated you for reasons you could not help, reasons unknown to you. How could you know you look like the son of an SS man, a Panzer man, some pilot from the Luftwaffe? Blue eyes sing to me only a song of death. Blue eyes met my family on the platform of Auschwitz. Your blue eyes grew up next door to my house in Waterford. With blue eyes, Mengele pointed left and sent my whole family to the gas chamber. Shyla, too, went to the left when she walked into your arms. You have never met an artist like me. No, an artist as I once was. I rose out of the long traditions of Europe, where artistry runs deep in the marrow of the selected few. Early, I indentured myself to the five horizontal lines where black notes were written on a sheet of music. It is a world of signs and notations that speaks to me with perfect clarity. It is a place of time signatures, fermatas, ledger lines, grace notes, and demi-semi-quavers that are the common tongue and heritage of musicians all over the world. It is something you know nothing about. As for music, you and your whole family are perfect idiots. It is something I cannot imagine being without. For without music, life is a journey through a desert that has not ever heard the rumor of God. In music's sweet harmony, I had all the proof I needed of a God who held the earth together between the staffs where the heavens lay. Here, he marked all the lines and spaces with notes so perfect that they praised all of his creation with their beauty. Once I thought I was good enough to play even the music that God had written and coded secretly in the alignment of stars. At least that is how I was taught to think. Look at the stars sometimes. They are only notes. They are music. Ah, the Holocaust, Jack. Yes. That word again, that stupid word, that empty vessel. I am so sick of that word. It is an exhausted word that means nothing, and we Jews have shoved it down the world's throat and dared anyone to use it improperly. One poor word cannot bear that much weight, yet this poor word must stagger under the load forever. The tracks of all the cattle cars, the moans of all the old people as they felt their own shit running down their legs in the befouled darkness, the screams of young mothers who watched as their infants died in their arms, the terrible thirst of children during the endless transits, the killing thirst, the thirst unforgettable until the millions rushed toward the ceilings of gas chambers, ripping off their bloody fingernails as the gas killed them like insects. Holocaust. One English word should not be required to carry so many human hearts. We are not survivors, none of us. We were dice. We were thrown, hurled into the mouth of hell,
and we learned that the human life was as worthless as a horsefly. Maggots hatching in excrement had a better chance of survival than a Jew caught up in the machinery of the Third Reich. The Nazis had a genius for death. When the war began, I had never seen a man die. Before it was over, I had come to terms with death, begging him to deliver me from a world beyond nightmare. I learned that nothing is worse than death's refusal to come. But death does not heed the wishes of mere dice. Dice just roll and come up with a number according to chance. But dice cannot feel. Dice are simply thrown, cast into the abyss. I can tell you how to find your way around in nothingness. I have the map in my possession, Jack. All the street names are covered with blood, and the streets are all cobbled with the skulls of Jews. You are a Christian, Jack, and you should feel right at home in this place. I hate your Christian face. I am sorry. I always have, and I always will. The killing of the Jews, the roundups, the unimaginable savagery, the unimaginable made commonplace. The Holocaust was a Christian production from first to last. Sometimes it was strictly a Catholic one. It all began with an observant Jew, this Christ. This same Jewish Christ has seen millions of his brothers and sisters killed in his name. This Christ who was circumcised, who kept faith with Jewish law to the letter, whose followers hunt down Jews like microbes or vermin. Even the cries of our children cannot move the Christian heart. The crying of our babies enraged the German soldiers. Babies. Their lack of control was an affront to the Reich. They were lucky when they made it as far as the gas chamber doors. You hate my eyes, Jack. Everyone hates my eyes, because they are cold, dead. You think I do not know this? I have a mirror. I avoid my eyes even when I shave. These eyes died in my head a long time ago and were forced to go on living because my body was alive. I can force myself to remember nothing, but my eyes saw, and there are bodies hung on meat hooks just behind my retina. My eyes become tinny and opaque from overexposure to horror. My eyes are repellent, not because they long for rest, but because they long for oblivion. It is all cliché now. Who has not heard this story 1,000 times before? Jews cry out, "We must never forget," and then proceed to tell the same tale over and over again, so repetitively, so desperately, that the words unravel around the edges, grow indistinct, and even I want to cover my ears and say, "Shut up," to whoever is speaking. I am afraid that a time will come when our story cannot be heard because it has been told too often. It is a cliché because of German exactitude. Once they settled on the machinery of death, the Nazis did not deviate in their methodology. They entered every city, town, and shtetl with a careful blueprint for the destruction of Jews. All of us tell the same story, only small details change. I was not born among Jews like you know here in Waterford. My father was a Berliner who fought for the Kaiser and who was wounded and decorated for his courage at the Somme. My mother's people were musicians and factory owners famous throughout Poland. These were people of the world, Jack, who had tasted the very best Europe had to offer. The Jews of Waterford are descendant from the dregs of Russian and Polish Jewry, the ones who lived out their lives unlettered and unschooled, and smelling of raw potatoes and herring going bad. Why do you raise your eyebrows at me? You must understand this, or you will understand nothing about me. Ruth is a descendant of such people. They were peasants who were peddlers and woodcutters, who spoke Yiddish by day and searched their body hair for lice at night. In America, they would be like the black ones, the Schwarzen. I make no judgment, but this is who Ruth is and who I am. These are the origins. The history of Europe and my family conspired to make me a musician. I composed my first sonata when I was 7.
At 14, I wrote a symphony in honor of my mother's 40th birthday. There is not a family in South Carolina as cultivated as the one into which I was born. I say this for definition's sake. There is no arrogance in my claim, just fact. Europe marked my family in its depths. It enfolded us in a culture that was 1,000 years in the making. America has no culture. She is still in diapers. I had 4 sisters, all older than me. Their names were Beatrice, Tosca, Tonya, and Cordelia. Not Jewish names, you will note, but names chosen with discrimination from the worlds of literature and opera. Laughter followed them wherever they went. All married well, brilliantly. They seemed like young lionesses to me, strong, willful, and they refused to let my mother say a single harsh word to me. Whenever my poor mother would try to scold me, these sisters would surround me in a protective circle, their silk dresses brushing up against me, their tiny waists eye level, their hands caressing me and stroking my hair, their 4 voices arguing with my poor, outnumbered mama. My father would read the paper, amused, as though he were watching the latest comedy from Paris. We were not good Jews. We were good Europeans. My father's library was breathtaking to behold, with its leather sets of Dickens, Tolstoy, Balzac, and Zola. He was well-schooled and brilliantly polished. As a factory owner, he was beloved. He avoided crassness, authoritarianism, and from his vast reading, he knew that the happiness of workers would come back to him 1,000 times in the riches that contentment always brings. My family attended synagogue on the high holidays only. They were humanists, rationalists. My father was something of a free thinker, a man with his head in the clouds when he was not adding columns of numbers or ordering supplies for his factory. In our house in Warsaw, my mother was the center of the universe, and she wanted her children to have everything in the world. I was her only son, and she worshipped me as few children have ever been worshipped. Her smile was like the sun to me. She was my first piano teacher. From the beginning, she told me I would be a master. She had no enemies, except, of course, the entire Christian world, but I did not know this as a boy. At 18, I won an important competition for young pianists in Paris. My main competition was from a Dutchman by the name of Shoemaker. He was a true artist, but did not love the spotlight. Another pianist was Geoffrey Stoppard of London, very strong. He had beautiful touch, but no sense of drama. The critics said I moved like the Prince of Darkness when I approached the piano. They nicknamed me Le Loup Noir, the Black Wolf. There was a German pianist I remember best. His name was Heinrich Baumann, and he was of the second tier in ability. He was passionate about music, but lacked the true gift, which he knew even then. For years, we wrote each other letters, discussing music, careers, everything. The night after the competition, we walked through Paris all night, and we were sitting on the steps of the Sacré-Cœur when the sun rose over the city and turned the old buildings rose-colored and breathtaking. A city looks more beautiful after you have won a competition. Heinrich had finished 3rd, his best finish ever. His letters stopped in 1938. Then it had become dangerous to write to a Jew, even the Black Wolf. Single-mindedness is something I was born with. It is a necessary ingredient of all the great musicians. The pursuit of greatness means that laziness has no place in your life. In the morning, I would work on my scales. I am a great believer in the scales. Master the grammar of scales, and the secrets of the best composers will reveal themselves to you in slow increments. My gift made harsh requirements of me. It made me aloof to all courtesies. I was neither kind nor cordial, and dreamed only of black notes pouring off a scale like water over rocks. When I turned to new symphonies, I felt as happy as those astronauts who first stepped on the moon. But why do I waste my time telling you this story, Jack? You could not play chopsticks on the piano with the great Horowitz holding your hand.
One of Shiloh's most unforgivable betrayals was marrying a man who was an ignoramus when it came to music. I had a first wife, Jack. I also had 3 sons.
You did not know I had a wife before Ruth?
No.
You did not know I had children before Shiloh and Martha?
No. It makes no difference. There is nothing in it to talk about the dead. Do you agree?
No.
You do not know what it is like to lose a wife.
Yes, I do, I said.
Sonia and I were destined to meet. She was beautiful as the music I played to praise her. She, too, played the piano uncommonly well, especially for a woman of that time and place. I played in Warsaw soon after my triumph in Paris. The concert was sold out weeks in advance. My name was on the lips of every aficionado in Poland. That night was my coming out in my own birthplace. I tell you, I was utterly brilliant that night, flawless. I closed the performance with the 3rd Hungarian Rhapsody by Liszt, because it is showy and crowd-pleasing. Sonia sat in the 2nd row, and I saw her when I walked onto the stage to begin my performance. She was like a pure flame burning out of control in that theater. Now, at this moment, I can close my eyes and see her as though time could not manage to extricate itself from that distinguished moment. She was the kind of woman accustomed to being noticed, and she saw me see her, saw the exact moment of my surrender and her conquest, when I let myself be stolen away by her. I lost myself forever in that first glance. Though I played before an audience of over 500 that night, I actually played only for her. When I rose to acknowledge the standing ovation, I noticed that she alone had refused to stand. Later, when I met her, I asked her why she had remained seated. She told me, "Because I wanted to make sure you would seek me out to ask that very question." Our marriage was one of the largest and most jubilant ever among the Jews of Warsaw. Both of our families were rich and cultured, and hers was even famous for producing a line of distinguished rabbis on her mother's side that could be traced back to the 18th century. We took our wedding trip to Paris, where we stayed at the Hotel George V, and we wandered hand in hand through all the streets of Paris. In France, we spoke to each other only in French. We made love whispering French to each other, and I lost my shyness with her when I whispered French into her ear at night. Later, she would claim I made her pregnant on our first night together. Our bodies burned when we were together. I do not have any other way of saying it. I think it happens but once, and only to the very young, when it feels like your skin could ignite at the mere touch of another person. I could not satisfy myself with her, or get enough of that endless feast her body provided. You get to love like that but once. Sonia knew music almost as well as I knew it. She would sit in the room as I practiced, and I played for her approval. Never have I had an audience as spontaneous and knowledgeable as Sonia was. Her pregnancy was a source of great joy to us both, and I poured out my soul at the keyboard so my sleeping, developing child could hear the most beautiful music in the world as it grew bones and lived in the womb of its mother. At that time, I had moments when I was sentimental as the next man. But you have never known this side of me. Long ago, I buried that part of me. I never looked back upon it or sang Kaddish or offered it a word of praise. Sonia loved it more than I did. My twin boys, Joseph and Aram, were born on your July 4th. I played a song I wrote for that occasion all during Sonia's labor, because that was the wish of my Sonia. So, Jack, not so many years pass, but it was a time that now seems like perfect happiness. Beneath the approving gaze of pretty Sonia and the sound of my growing boys in the nursery, I began to outreach even the talent I was born with. I reached that point where I could make the piano mourn or cry out or exult by laying my fingers just so. But the Nazi beast was growing. As a Jew, one felt hunted in the great cities as the voice of Hitler poisoned the airways. As a musician, I thought I was immune to the fury of armies and the fate of my fathers made little difference when I sat down before the music sheets and interpreted those passionate notes that Brahms, Chopin, Schumann, that all the great ones had left the world. Hitler meant nothing to me because of music and Sonia and my beautiful twin boys. When the newspapers disturbed me, I simply stopped reading the newspaper. When rumors flew wildly in the streets, I stayed indoors and commanded that Sonia do the same. When the radio made Sonia weep with fear, I turned off the radio and forbade its use. I refused to listen to the baying of the Nazi hound. Politics sickened and bored me. Then I heard scratching at my door, unprepared and in innocence, and saw the Nazi beast. So I played my music to calm the bloodlust of the Nazi beast. This beast loved my music, came to my concerts, called for encores, threw roses on the stages, and bellowed out my name. It loved music so much, Jack, that I almost did not see the moment that it wiped the blood of my family from its fangs and claws. Jew-hating Poland was attacked by Jew-hating Germany. It was not until later that I learned that World War II had begun, and I and my family were in the middle of it all. I learned in the first days of the war that I was not a man of action. How is a musician supposed to respond to dive bombers? I found myself paralyzed with fright, and I remained at the piano during the first bombing raid because I discovered I could not move. The piano seemed safer to me, friendlier than the basement where my wife and neighbors had fled. I heard the approach of planes and the air raid sirens go off, and I knew what I should do, but I could not make myself run. Instead, I found myself playing from the second movement of Beethoven's Piano Sonata, number 32, in C minor, opus 111. The very last moment of his last sonata of the complete set of 32. You have never been in a country invaded. You cannot understand the chaos, the despair, the panic in the streets. I think it is why modern music and modern art are so ugly. My wife Sonia found me, after the bombers had returned to their bases, sitting on the piano bench, still playing, as though possessed. I had urinated in my pants. Such was my fear during that first raid. I think I thought my music would save me, form a protective barrier that would hover over me like some impregnable umbrella. Sonia was very kind and gentle with me. "It is all right, my husband. Here, let me help you. Let me assist you. Please lean against me." I do not remember having a single thought about Sonia or my sons during the bombing. Not one. Until that moment, it had never occurred to me that I was a coward of the most despicable kind. Now, even Sonia knew it. Sonia's father, Saul Youngerman, was a man of action. He could think clearly under pressure. Already he had read Hitler's Mein Kampf and had watched his rise in Germany with a distrustful eye. He was a rich manufacturer who possessed fortunes in four countries, and he told us he knew what Hitler had in mind. He commanded that we run east as fast as we could, keeping well ahead of the German army. His two sons, Marek and Stefan, refused to leave Warsaw because their wives were city girls, born and bred to expect the comforts of Warsaw life. They had school-age children, and even if the Germans won, they could not prevent their children from going to school. It is easy to mock their stupidity now, but remember, this was a time when the words Treblinka, Auschwitz, and Mauthausen had no meaning to the world. Not a single member of Sonia's family who stayed in Warsaw survived the war. Not one. With all the madness in the streets, with Warsaw itself wounded and bleeding, Saul Youngerman arranged for us to leave by boat, down the Vistula by barge, and then by oxen and wagons, which drove us 20 kilometers to a farm where two touring cars were waiting with uniformed chauffeurs. It was not the fact that Sonia's father was rich that made a difference. Many were the rich men who perished from starvation in the Warsaw ghetto. It was that he had formed a plan in his head if something happened, and he was not bashful in putting it into effect. By daytime we slept, and by night we moved. When we came to a border after the fourth night of very hard travel, we crossed into a territory controlled by the Red Army. Saul figured that his family would be safe there, since Ribbentrop and Molotov had signed a Nazi-Soviet non-aggression pact. His wife's brother runs a factory there and knows we are coming. On 5 September, we are taken in by the family Spiegel. We are put up in a beautiful house with a very fine piano that had recently been tuned in preparation for my arrival. The city that offers us deliverance is in the Ukraine. It is called Kirenitska. The wheel of fate comes round to touch you unawares. This is the place from which your great Jew, Max Russoff, and his wife Esther are from. But fate reveals itself only slowly and in its own good time. So we are there, and every day I play the piano, and crowds of people gather outside on the street to listen to my music. Everything is good for us in Kirenitska from the beginning. Many people there are Jews, some 20,000, so we are well taken care of. News from Warsaw is worse each day, but we know this only from the radio. On 17 September, the Soviet Union attacks Poland from the east. I take on music students, and some of them are very good, but it is not the life I would choose. My father-in-law takes several trips, fraught with terrible danger, back to Warsaw. He takes food and medicine to our family, then sneaks back after terrifying adventures to Kirenitska. I have never known a braver man. The stories he brought back from Warsaw were each worse than the time before. By November, the main Jewish areas are enclosed in barbed wire. Jews are ordered to wear the Star of David. Saul Youngerman cannot be persuaded from still another trip back to Poland. He considers himself a Polish patriot more than a Jew. Though we do not know this, my Sonia is pregnant with our third child when we arrive in Kirenitska. But the child does not know the world it is coming into and continues to grow inside her. Though we are sick with worry about our loved ones in Poland, we are thankful that we have escaped. My third son, Jonathan, is born in June. If I could have seen the future, I would have beaten Jonathan's brains out on a rock beside the river. I would have fed rat poison to my twins, to Sonia, then myself. In June 1941, the Germans declare war on the Soviet Union. On June 22, there is the first massive airstrike on the civilian population of Kirenitska. 3 weeks later, after being occupied by Hungarian troops for a brief period, I hear spoken in the streets the four most fearful words I have ever heard. The Germans are here. The Germans are here. At this very instant, things change for the Jews. Because the Soviet Union is an ally of Germany, we have relaxed our guard and considered ourselves safe. Rumors have come to us from Warsaw and then parts of Poland about the fate of Jews, but we discount them. After all, the Germans are human as we are. That year, I begin to go to the synagogue for morning prayers. And then, one day, the Germans burn the synagogue to the ground with 100 Jews inside it. If Sonia had not been sick that morning, I would have perished along with the rest. I consider those Jews that burned to death that morning to be the lucky ones. And then the Gestapo comes, inhuman, but handsome in a way that makes your blood run cold. The genius of the Gestapo is in their pride that they have graduated far beyond mercy. You cannot appeal to them on a human level because they are superhuman. A Ukrainian businessman owns the largest mansion in the city, and this house is taken over by the Hauptsturmführer, Rudolf Kruger, for his headquarters. Kuzak is the name of the businessman, and he protests that his family is one of the most distinguished in the Ukraine, and that he demands the respect the name Kuzak merits in the city. Kruger obliges and hangs poor Kuzak from a timber protruding from his own house. The body is allowed to hang there for weeks as a sign to the citizens of Kirenitska. Not until it begins to smell does Kruger order it cut down and thrown into a sewer. Of course, the Germans incur many unfortunate and necessary expenses in their war against the Jews. They are forced to levy heavy taxes on the Jewish population. They enlist the help of the Ukrainians in this. If the Ukrainians ever live down this ugly chapter of their history,
then it means that God was asleep for the whole war. Instead of wearing the usual yellow armband, the Jews of Kironitska are required to wear a white one with a blue Jewish star that measures 10 centimeters wide. Those Jews deliver all gold and silver articles to the offices of the Judenrat. My wedding ring and Sonia's are lost in this order. All electrical appliances and shoe leather are gathered up. All German books are confiscated. We are in the hands of criminals, murderers, and thieves, God's chosen people. Some poor misguided Jews hear that if they convert to Christianity, they will be spared the horrible fate of their compatriots. One Friday, there is a mass baptism where 20 entire Jewish families, with but a few exceptions among older members, are baptized. The Gestapo has a baptismal present ready and waiting for these new Gentiles. They are marched into the Christian cemetery and gunned down with machine gun fire. Children and women, no exception. Later, a member of the Judenrat, when he had gotten to know Kruger somewhat better, asks him why. Kruger makes it a joke. He says, if you take a pig inside a cathedral, you still have ham and bacon, and the cathedral has not changed at all. That member of the Judenrat is me. Judenrat, you do not know the word, Jack. It is my shame that I live with it. I have never admitted to anyone that I held such a position until this night when I tell you everything. Kruger selects a committee of Jews to administrate the Jewish affairs of this new ghetto. Failure to join means swift and certain death. By joining, it means I get to collaborate with the Germans in the torture and destruction of my own people. When the Germans need a work brigade to repair a bridge, a list of Jews is turned over to Kruger by the Judenrat. Whenever the Germans decide to reduce the size of the ghetto during an Aktion, we decide which Jews will be rounded up in the ghetto's main plaza, loaded on trucks, and driven away, never to be seen again. By doing this, I think I am saving the lives of Sonia and my boys. And I am, but saving them for what? The leader of the Judenrat is a surgeon named Isaac Weinberger. He is a contemplative, patient man who assumes that the Nazis can be reasoned with like all other men. He is the one who insists that my father-in-law, Saul Youngerman, be in the Judenrat. Immediately, Saul sees all the dangers inherent in such a position, but also sees the wisdom in serving with such a group for the sake of his family. It is Saul who insists on my participation. Very early, he scares me by telling me in confidence that the Nazis plan to kill every Jew on the face of the earth. I laugh when he tells me this. I tell him that wartime brings out in each man the capacity for the grossest exaggeration. Taking off his glasses and wiping them, Saul tells me that he has always admired my genius, but that it does not protect me from thinking like a fool. We are in our quarters in the ghetto, my children are playing around us, and my wife and mother-in-law are gossiping at the stove while fixing dinner. They are all corpses, Saul Youngerman whispers to me. They are all corpses. On 30 August, the Judenrat is required to provide the Germans with a list of all the Jewish intellectuals. In this list are 270 teachers, 34 pharmacists, 126 physicians, 35 engineers. I am also included in this list as a musician. The next day, 100 men are selected from this list. They assemble together at daybreak, mount trucks, wave goodbye to their weeping families, and disappear from the face of the earth. Except for one man. His name is Lauber, and he is one of the 34 pharmacists on the list. He comes back to the ghetto at night, sneaking in as though this is deliverance. What he longs for is the comforting arms of his wife and the sounds of his children's voices. This he finds. He tells his story to the other wives whose husbands left in those trucks. They are driven 50 kilometers to a bean field, where they are given shovels and ordered to dig. They dig a great hole, then strip naked and kneel beside their handiwork. Then the machine guns of the Nazis relieve them of the burdens of this war. The chosen people return to the God who chose them. No one believes this man, Lauber. The Gestapo discovers him. They take him, his wife, his children, his parents, and two other families in his house to the Jewish cemetery, where all of them are shot. Only then does poor Lauber not look like a liar. Lauber's wife dies screaming at him that he should not have come back. Hauptsturmfuhrer Kruger is a cruel Philistine and a pig who tries to assume airs of breeding and sophistication that he has not earned. To Dr. Weinberger, he talks of his love of Wagner, yet cannot name one of the arias he loves to whistle. Weinberger tells him about me, and I am ordered to play the piano for a group of a German war staff who are on their way to the front lines. While they eat, I play and I listen to the Germans talk about the war effort and their many successes on the Russian front. They talk like normal men until they get drunk, when they begin to talk like Nazi soldiers. At this feast, they consume more meat than the Jews of the ghetto have seen since the walls of the ghetto went up. Then they go to the library for cigars and cognac. All except one officer, who comes beside the piano and listens to me play. You still play like an angel, even in times like this. I look up and see my friend, Heinrich Baumann. He sits down beside me on the bench, and we take turns playing music for each other. He plays Mozart, and I answer him with Chopin. As we play, Baumann asks about my situation and that of my family. He tells me that I have much to worry about because I am a Jew. After that dinner, he drives me to my house in the ghetto in his Jeep. Soldiers salute him. He is a fighting man, not SS. At my home, he comes in and meets Sonia and kisses my children in their sleep. He bows when he meets Saul Youngerman and my mother-in-law. In a sack, he leaves a wonderful supply of flour and cans of meat and sacks of cornmeal. When he leaves, Herr Baumann kisses me and apologizes for the entire German nation. We are still part of the Brotherhood of Music, he tells me. He is killed leading his men against the Soviet troops at Stalingrad. A good German? No. Herr Baumann fought for Hitler's armies. At best, he was a member of the Judenrat like me. There are few Germans who could not forgive my participation in the Judenrat. They know me. I am one of them in some profound way that ties us together in all our sad humanity. We dance with the enemy and let him lead. Do you think you could throw your daughter Leah into a crematorium, Jack? Of course you do not. Your love for her is too great, correct? Let me starve you for a year. Let me beat you into submission. Let me kill everyone you love around you and work you until you drop. Let me humiliate you and fill your hair with lice and your bread with maggots. Let me test you to the limit and find out where civilization ends and depravity begins along the edges of your soul. Here is what they did to me, Jack. At the end of the war, I could have thrown the Messiah himself into the fires of the crematorium, and I would have done it for an extra cup of soup. I could throw Ruth, Shiloh, Martha, Sonia, my sons, Leah, and everyone else into those fires and never think of it again. Here is the trick, Jack. You have to break a man down completely, and then you own him. Let me break you like they broke me, and I promise you, you would throw Leah into a fire, hang her by her neck, see her raped by 100 men, then have her throat cut and her bodily parts thrown to starving dogs in the street. I upset you. I am sorry. I tell you what I know. But know this. It is possible for you to kill Leah with your own hands, because the world has come apart, and God has hidden his face in his hands, and you will think, by killing her, you are proving your love of Leah like never before. I would kill Leah myself, tonight, before I would let her go through what I did, Jack. And I love your daughter more than I love any person on this earth. No, she does not remind me of the sons I mourn, nor does she remind me of Shiloh. She is much calmer and more composed than Shiloh ever was. No, your Leah strikes me in a place I thought was dead. She reminds me of Sonia, my sweet lost wife.
Kruger seems to grow fond of me, and it agrees with his pretensions about himself and his culture to have me play the piano while he dines. He gets drunk easily, and he cries. His only son, Wilhelm, comes back from the Russian front to celebrate his 19th birthday. Both father and son get drunk, and they make me play German folk songs over and over. Then they chase me out when two Ukrainian whores arrive for their appointment. The next day, 10 Jewish young men are selected and driven 15 kilometers to a field leading to a river. These Jews are told they can make a run for the river, and if they reach the water, they will be free men. Kruger and his son are in the middle of the field, 50 meters away, with high-powered hunting rifles. As the Jews run, father and son take turns shooting down the running Jews. They are excellent marksmen. No matter how they dodge or how fast they run, no Jew makes it to the river. Kruger tells me the story later one evening when he demands that I play nothing but Haydn.
An old Orthodox rabbi named Nebenstahl is caught praying and is publicly humiliated by the Gestapo. They make him spit on the sacred Torah until he can no longer spit. Then they make him urinate on the Torah. Then they want him to shit on the Torah, which he cannot do because he has not eaten. They bring him bread. Loaf after loaf they stuff down his throat. But they are too vigorous in making him eat bread, and they strangle him on the bread and leave him in the street. Jews fight over the bread they leave sticking out of the mouth of the dead rabbi. Another rabbi retrieves a defiled Torah and buries it with great solemnity and secrecy in the Jewish cemetery. In October, the Judenrat is required by Kruger to make another selection, this time of 1,000 Jews. The ghetto is shrinking still again. We choose the lowest Jews among us, the poorest and the most despised. The sick and the hungry are easy targets, and so are the very old, who have produced no families of distinction. We protect our families and those of our friends. Each time we waltz with the enemy, we cheapen and degrade ourselves. After the selection is over and the trucks depart, the Nazis give us extra food for our families. For a loaf of extra bread, we sell the children of Israel into something far worse than slavery. My father-in-law takes me almost by force to his factory one day. The head of his clothing factory has followed the Russians out of the city, and Saul has to take over its operation. It is a clothing factory that the Germans turn into an operation for the making of winter coats for the military. Saul puts me next to a master tailor and orders the man to teach me to sew a coat. I am furious and scream at him that I am a pianist and that this is a place where peasants work. Saul grabs me and shakes me. He is old but strong. "Learn how to sew," he screams at me. "Learn how to do something the Germans can use, that they need." So the master tailor shows me how to sew along a seam. He makes me do it until I do it right. There is a whole different set of things to know about zippers and collars. Saul comes back to check on me, and we argue again. But he makes me come each day. I sew when I should be practicing scales. I sew when I should be mastering the great composers. I sew, and I hate my father-in-law. I tell you now, over 40 years later, that this man I hate, Saul Youngerman, wants to save my life by teaching me to be a tailor. The Nazis would have sent Beethoven himself to the gas chamber, unless he could have sewn a shirt for a soldier on the Eastern Front. He made me a musician and a tailor. A young Gestapo man named Schmidt causes great fear among the Jews. He has a habit of slapping down Jewish men in the street when he passes them by. Schmidt loves it because some of the older men begin falling to their knees at the sight of him. Once, I see this with my own eyes. Schmidt is walking down the street in the ghetto, and every man is kneeling before him. I am one of those men. Schmidt looks like an albino and is a notorious rapist. He would rape Ukrainian or Polish girls as soon as he would rape Jewish ones. There is only one difference. The Jewish girls he defiles as their parents listen in the next room, and then he shoots them. Some of them are no more than children. Jews hide their daughters when word spreads that Schmidt is approaching the ghetto. Soon you know that a Jewish life is worth less than nothing. This is the only sure thing in the ghetto,
starvation becomes the daily lot. The search for food becomes a desperate thing. The 14 entrances of the ghetto are all guarded by Ukrainian police. Some of the Ukrainians are kind, and they suffer the same horrors as the fate of the Jews they try to help. Low-life Jewish informers testify about the kindness of the Ukrainians, and they are removed from these barriers, never to be seen again. The Ordnungsdienst wear a military-like uniform designed by their own members. They are Jewish police, and they earn favors by acting as informants to the Gestapo. They are stooges of the Gestapo. But I must tell you, they are no worse than I am. The ghetto is an abattoir, and all of us are beasts marked for slaughter. The only way a Jew can prove his innocence in such a nightmare is to turn up dead. People begin to die of starvation, and their bodies are stacked like firewood outside of apartment buildings. Envy of the dead is common. There are Jews worse off than other Jews. I watch the men in charge of removing fecal matter to the river. These are starved, horrible-looking men who pull the wagons as though they are broken-down horses. The work is degrading, agonizing. A smell hangs over them, yet their work saves